Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Summer of Dash Pass is here. Get more to your door for less. Groceries, self-care, and restaurants. Subscribe to save up to 50% off your order. Plus, no delivery fees with Dash Pass from DoorDash. Start your 30-day free trial now. Terms apply.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 5th of July, these are our main stories. Israeli forces begin withdrawing from the Jenin refugee camp after one of the biggest military operations in the occupied West Bank in years. The army and rival paramilitary forces in Sudan's most populous city have engaged in some of the heaviest fighting since hostilities broke out in April. And dozens of Ukrainian civilians have been wounded in a Russian missile strike in the Kharkiv region. Also in this podcast, we hear why Monday was the world's hottest day ever recorded. And
where you would expect a motor, then there's a propulsion system, which actually gets car vertically up in the air as a rotorcraft.
The US approves the world's first fully electric flying car. Almost 48 hours after starting their military operation in the occupied West Bank, the Israeli army has begun withdrawing from Jenin. Israel's defense minister described the city as a terrorism factory which had now been closed down. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has accused Israel of declaring open war against the people of Jenin. At least a dozen Palestinians were killed, more than 100 injured, while in Tel Aviv, a militant drove a truck into pedestrians and then stabbed civilians. At least seven people were wounded before the Palestinian man was shot dead. Our Middle East correspondent Yoland Nell reports from Jenin City.
Today, the weary exodus continued from inside Jenin's built-up refugee camp. Mothers hurrying, carrying their children. Thousands of people have now left with help from the Palestinian Red Crescent. These families said they'd been trapped, surrounded by Israeli soldiers. A man in a wheelchair said it was terrifying when the raid began with airstrikes. Since yesterday, it's been very difficult. The drone was shooting at us, this man says. Now we've just left and we're all so tired. We've had nothing to eat or drink.
So I've come now to the entrance of Jenin refugee camp, this double arch. It's pretty familiar to me, but the street doesn't normally look like this. It would normally be teeming with life. Instead, we've got a few smouldering piles where people have been burning tyres. But outside the hospital just here, that's where crowds of young men have gathered, listening to the sound of what's going on inside the camp. Going back to the car, there's some gunfire very close to us here.
But after a few minutes in the armoured car, I'm able to enter the local hospital just nearby. Patients are now mostly being stabilised here before they're sent away to nearby cities for treatment. Dr. Bilal Rawajbe is head of emergencies.
In the hospital yesterday were a lot of patients, injured patients, and some of them died.
What kinds of injuries are you seeing?
Head injury, chest injury, abdominal bullet injury, and in the limbs.
And how has it been for you and for the doctors, the nurses here? Because I see some people look so tired.
Yeah, it's too difficult to work 24 hours without rest. Our surgeon, they worked 24 hours yesterday.
And you must feel so close to the camp. You can still hear gunfire, you hear explosions while you're trying to work?
Of course. We have to work. It's our job.
Near the hospital entrance, I find Umm Mohammed talking frantically to relatives on the phone. She tells me she left the camp last night, but had to rush here today as her young daughter needs kidney dialysis.
May God help us. May God have mercy on us. We don't know what to do. I don't know how we went out from our homes. We ran as fast as we could. We ran for our lives. My daughter is doing her dialysis. We brought her by ambulance. We don't know what to do after that.
And amid the continuing uncertainty, back outside, the fighting goes on.
Well, okay, time to go.
Yoland Nell. Anna Foster gave me an update on the latest developments from Jenin shortly before recording this podcast.
It's worth saying, because of the size and the scale of this operation, the number of military vehicles, the number of soldiers that were involved, the withdrawal, I think, is expected to take some time. But certainly the signs were there in the last few hours. I was overlooking Jenin a few hours ago, and we saw crossing through the West Bank barrier back into Israel, armoured vehicles, we saw troops. And interestingly, and I think this was perhaps a key indication that the operation was nearing its end, we saw a large military helicopter landing maybe just 30 or 40 metres ahead of us, and that turned out to be carrying Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, and Yoav Gallant, the Israeli Defence Minister. They visited troops who just come out of Jenin. They did an interview. They made statements about the fact that they felt that this operation, which has been the largest operation of its kind in the occupied West Bank for many years, they felt that it had achieved its goals, which was to send a strong message to Palestinian militant groups operating in Jenin, and also to dismantle as much as possible the infrastructure that they were working on inside that refugee camp. And Israel says that anybody who is planning to carry out attacks on Israeli civilians will be incorporated within those missions that they say that they carry out in order to keep their civilian population safe.
A risk, though, surely, that attitudes on the Palestinian side will only have been hardened.
Very much so. I mean, you look at the situation in the refugee camp there in Jenin, and we talk about the militants who are operating, but there are also many, many thousands of civilians who live there as well, of families, of women, of children, much younger children, who no part to play at all in these militant activities that are taking place. And this will no doubt have been a very frightening 48 hours for them to witness what has been going on. And as you say, that sort of simmering anger remains.
Anna Foster. In Sudan, the fighting has reached a new level of ferocity in parts of the country that had been relatively calm, like Omdurman near the capital Khartoum, which has seen some of the most intense clashes in the battles between the paramilitary RSF, or Rapid Support Forces, and the Sudanese army. Zainab Mohamed Salah is a journalist there, and she described the situation to Tim Franks.
The RSF was trying to retake one of the police special forces units in Omdurman, which is not too far from where I live. And there was intense fighting. It started at 5 a.m. and we were hearing all sorts of weapons, basically heavy artillery and airstrike, which made people to just remain indoors. It was really terrifying. It's still going on, actually. And one of the important things is my part of Khartoum, it remained relatively safer since the start of the war. But today could be the worst day since the 15th of April.
How do you try to keep yourself as safe as you can when such heavy weaponry is being used in confined civilian spaces?
We are indoors. We always, you know, find stray bullets all the time. You find them in your house. And my neighbor was hit on her leg and somebody else was hit on his hand. Luckily, they are safe, but that's the norm. And people could not even manage to go to the market to get some food today because the market was closed. There's a small market nearby has been closed because even those who sell the stuff there, of course, it doesn't feel safe for them. Oh, I need to go down. Oh, my God. Because there's this sound of...
I could hear
gunfire.
The sound of gunfire.
Yeah. Exactly. I need to go down because it doesn't feel safe. I'm upstairs.
Please, let's carry on speaking if you feel safe. If you want to hang up the telephone, that is absolutely fine.
Yeah, I'm okay now. I think I'm in the safest part. Sorry, I need to open the door. My siblings are outside and my mum. So sorry.
Do you want to check on them?
Let them in.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they are fine.
Okay.
They came in. Yeah.
Right.
So.
Oh my goodness! That sounded very close.
Yeah, it is actually. I hope this nightmare ends soon.
You said you hope this nightmare will be over soon. Are you seeing any signs? that it will be?
At the beginning, we were really hopeful when the US and Saudi Arabia, they came along and they tried to do this. But then people are hopeless now. Just a few days before the Eid, both of them, the Saudis and the Americans, they announced that they are going for holidays and people are here and the bombardment every single day. It just made people very kind of disappointed by the international community, actually. They have been announcing ceasefire after ceasefire, but they never hold. You know, thousands of people are being killed in the streets every single day.
Zainab Mohammed Salah, a journalist in Omdurman, speaking to Tim Franks. Ukrainian officials say a Russian missile strike in northwestern Kharkiv region has wounded more than 40 people. 12 of the injured are understood to be children. The blast in the town of Pervomaisky was close to a block of flats. Ukraine's prosecutor general described the attack as another Russian war crime. From Kyiv, here's our security correspondent Gordon Carrera.
A Russian Iskander missile struck at around 1:30 p.m. local time in a car park by a 9-storey residential building, local officials say. Images from the scene show damage to the building as well as burnt-out overturned cars and a large crater. Ukraine's prosecutor general described it as another war crime, saying that only residential buildings were in the area. Amongst the children injured were several infants, including one 3-month-old, according to officials. This is the latest in a series of attacks with significant civilian casualties. A drone strike on a residential building in Sumy killed 3 people on Monday. And last Tuesday, 13 people were killed in a missile strike on a pizza restaurant in Kramatorsk. Today in the capital, Kyiv, a memorial service was held for one of those killed in that attack. Victoria Amelina had paused her career as a novelist to document Russian war crimes. Her funeral will be in her hometown of Lviv on Wednesday afternoon.
Gordon Carrera. Neutrality has been a cornerstone of Swiss policy for a long time. But now there's controversy over the government's decision to join a European Defence Accord. It's a relatively new group called European Sky Shield, which was set up after the Russian invasion of Ukraine last year. So, why would Switzerland want to join? Our correspondent in Bern, Imogen Folks, explains.
Well, there's nothing like war in Europe started by a huge, well-armed country, Russia, to make a small country like Switzerland focus on its security. And in this case, it's the air defence. Now, Switzerland, it's not as radical perhaps as it appears to some. Switzerland works with NATO in partnership for peace. It's had for 2 decades a battalion in Kosovo in the KFOR troops. So it does cooperate. In this case, obviously, the government thinks this could be good for us participating, not necessarily in air forces working together, but in procurement and coordination. But some people are not too happy. They think it bucks this long, long tradition.
I was going to say, a de facto end to Swiss neutrality would be pretty controversial in Switzerland, wouldn't it?
You know, maybe not as controversial as you think. Ever since Russia invaded Ukraine, it has been an almost continuous searching of souls in this country. Is this neutrality fit for purpose? Let's not forget it was imposed on Switzerland in the 19th century by bigger powers who wanted a buffer between them. Since then, it's become a bit of a sacred thing. And some people, the right-wing Swiss People's Party, they really think Switzerland shouldn't join anything. They didn't want Switzerland to join the United Nations way back when, for the same reason. But others think that it really needs a long, hard look. I was at a dinner last week where a very old Swiss journalist said, "This is crazy. We have to stop this. Russia invaded Ukraine and you can't stay neutral in the face of aggression like that."
So what is the Swiss position in the war against Ukraine?
They have adopted all of the economic sanctions after literally a couple of days of hesitation after the EU introduced them. The Swiss adopted them. That prompted the Kremlin to say, "Oh, look, Switzerland's not neutral anymore," which upset some people. Since then, they've got themselves into a very tight spot about whether they should export weapons or allow other countries who've bought Swiss-made weapons to re-export them to Ukraine. There are many members of parliament who want to send Switzerland's aging Leopard tanks to Ukraine because Switzerland, as we know, is not using them. They haven't come to a decision. Some people do think that would really cross the line of this fabled neutrality. But again, I think that could be a move. If this war continues and if we see the kind of brutal ground war that we've started to see now around Bakhmut and so on, I think again we might see a decision on seeing those Leopard tanks first go back to Germany, where they came from, and then Germany perhaps sending them to Ukraine.
Imogen Folks. Still to come on the Global News podcast, a new and worrying climate milestone as Monday was the hottest day ever recorded.
It's down to a combination of human emissions of carbon dioxide from all the things that we do, plus the El Niño weather phenomenon.
President Macron has announced a bill to help France rebuild after the country's worst rioting for two decades, following the police shooting of a teenager last week. Mr. Macron made the announcement during talks with more than 200 mayors he'd invited to the presidential palace on Tuesday. Last week's riots have exposed deep divisions in French society. In Marseille, where there were violent clashes over the weekend, people living in one of the city's most deprived and violent neighbourhoods have been telling the BBC that they feel abandoned by politicians. Jenny Hill reports.
In a divided country, a city of two halves. Marseille's port is bright, bustling, cosmopolitan. Yachts gleam on the turquoise water. But come to the northern districts, where tower blocks rise scruffily into the sky, and no one's surprised that riots broke out. These neighbourhoods are notorious, deprived and dangerous. It's like living in a bin, Mardo tells us. It's not safe. People defecate in the lifts and stairwells. For the politicians, she says, we are nothing. We are really nothing. Omar tells us young people here struggle to find a job or training. And for many, drug dealing is a seductive choice. But it got Amin Kasachi's brother killed. His body was recovered, badly burned, from the boot of a torched car.
This is the only solution the young people have. There are no companies coming here and saying we'll pay you more than minimum wage. Here people are supermarket cashiers or cleaners or security guards. We can't be judges, lawyers or accountants.
And President Macron knows it. He was here just before the riots, greeted by crowds and cameras to refresh his promise made 2 years ago to fix Marseille. More money, more support. But Amin's now met him twice and lost faith.
When Macron comes, he comes to make announcements, not to listen to us. We are always in the same mess, the same misery, and nothing will change. So I understand the anger of the young people. I don't justify the violence, but I understand it.
The government is spending money on schools, public transport, police. It's just that people here don't notice a difference.
This used to be a community police station. For some, perhaps one of the last remaining physical links to the French state. No wonder so many here tell us they feel cut off, left to fend for themselves.
And even the mayor of Marseille, Benoît Payan, acknowledges he needs to bring his city together.
For too long, my town has been divided between people who are poor and people who are not, between those who are considered by the public authorities and those who are not.
It's supposed to be a fundamental French value. But here, égalité, equality, is now an ambition.
Jenny Hill reporting from Marseille. Hungarian students and teachers held a protest outside the parliament in Budapest on Tuesday, shortly after the assembly had passed a bill which is set to increase the working hours of teachers and limit their ability to speak out against the government in class. Public money for education as a share of government spending has fallen over the last few years. The teacher Gábor Bálint left his post at a public school in Budapest last year and now works at a private school instead.
The working conditions have been deteriorating. Our pay is worth less and less because of the inflation, because we don't get any pay rise. So it's harder and harder to make ends meet solely from a teacher's salary. There are problems with what we can teach and the curriculum. So there have been all these problems.
Our correspondent Nick Thorpe in Budapest told me more about the new legislation.
Basically, what the law adds up to, the government's calling it a career path law. It's been known in Hungary as a status law. So effectively, it's changing teachers. There are about 140,000 of them in Hungary, from a public servant status to a public education employee status. That, many teachers say, will make their situation even worse. The government, in defence of the law, says, look, it actually adds up to, for many teachers, a wage increase and the promise of more. It guarantees them 10 weeks paid leave. It says it limits the number of classroom hours to 24 a week, and that basically it's a good thing, and it's what the Hungarian education system actually needs to shake it up.
So from what you say, most teachers opposed to it. What do parents think?
Parents and especially students have been taking part in these protests for the last year. Some of those protests have been violent, you know, in front of the Prime Minister's office, when students several nights in a row tried to dismantle barricades. The police used tear gas against them, and obviously that went down pretty badly, certainly in the opposition or independent media here. So basically, but the government does enjoy this huge majority in Parliament. In opinion polls, it's still running at 46% against the combined opposition's 41%. But as the teacher we heard from there was saying, inflation's very high at the moment, 20%. Teachers in Hungary are the worst paid in the whole of the European Union, comparatively speaking. And the teachers are saying that basically this new law will make things worse rather than better.
Nick Thorpe in Budapest. Monday, for many of us, was the hottest average day ever recorded globally, according to data from the US National Centers for Environmental Prediction, a government agency. With more details, here's our environment correspondent, Matt McGrath.
Well, since the start of this year, scientists have been growing increasingly concerned about temperatures on land and at sea. There was record spring heat in Spain and in many countries in Asia, and this was followed by massive marine heat waves in places that don't normally see them, such as the North Sea in Europe. This week, China has continued to experience an enduring heat wave, as has the southern United States. And all that's combined on Monday to see temperatures reach a new global average high record of 17.01 degrees Celsius, the first time they've gone past 17 degrees in the satellite record that dates back to 1979. And scientists believe this is the highest daily average temperature since reliable records began at the end of the 19th century. So what's driving this? Well, it's down to a combination of human emissions of carbon dioxide from all the things that we do, plus the El Niño weather phenomenon that's driving lots of heat to the surface of the Pacific Ocean. Scientists say this milestone isn't something to be celebrated. It is, in fact, something to be worried about. And they believe that because El Niño is continuing to strengthen, we may see more of these daily, perhaps weekly, even monthly records over the period of the summer.
Matt McGrath. The University of Oxford has handed over nearly 100 cows to two Maasai families in Kenya in exchange for cultural artefacts allegedly stolen from East Africa more than a century ago. The cows were given to the two families in the southwestern Narok County at the weekend. Our Africa regional editor Richard Hamilton reports.
When a Kenyan scholar, Samuel Sankiriaki, first visited the Pitt Rivers Museum in 2017, he was shocked to discover so many valuable Maasai artefacts there. These included sacred objects such as tribal elders' necklaces and headgear worn by girls for rite of passage ceremonies. The Pitt Rivers Museum, which is part of Oxford University, acknowledged that it holds nearly 150 Maasai objects and has done so for more than a century, but it insists that the vast majority of these were not wrongly acquired, but were considered as gifts at the time. The museum has set up what it calls the Maasai Living Cultures Project. This included a healing ceremony in Kenya and the presentation of 98 cows to the Maasai. The museum declined to be interviewed by the BBC, but did issue a statement.
The Pitt Rivers Museum's mission is to engage people across the world, increase understanding of humanity's many ways of knowing, and extend our reach through innovative partnerships such as this one.
However, a spokesperson for the Maasai family said that while they welcome the gift of cows, they were still expecting adequate compensation. The museum's gesture comes amid the wider, controversial issue of cultural restitution. While France and Germany have started returning some objects that were taken during the colonial era, Britain seems less keen to do so. The most notable case is that of the Benin bronzes, which for now are still being held by the British Museum in London.
Richard Hamilton. The aviation authority in the US, the FAA, has just approved the testing of the world's first fully electric flying car. Aleph Aeronautics vehicle has been given a special airworthiness certification, meaning the company will now be allowed to conduct land and air testing. And with that, the company is now taking pre-orders from customers. The CEO of Aleph Aeronautics, Jim Duchovny, told James Copnell what it's like.
It is actually a car and it's actually a flight. So on the ground, it's an electric car, it's a regular EV. It looks like EV, it functions like EV, it parks like EV. It does everything which your regular Tesla or your Toyota would do. That being said, where you would expect a motor, then there is actually no motor. So there's four motors in four wheels. Instead, where you expect a motor, there's a propulsion system, which actually gets car vertically up in the air as a rotorcraft, in which case you can go above the traffic or above any kind of terrain which you need to bypass or anything you need to bypass. Then it goes flying forward. So up to this point, everything was fine, but with the best energy density today, there was a problem why we did not have flying cars for 100 years since before Henry Ford people tried it. And one of the biggest problems was energy density. So what our car does in order to make it very efficient flying, it turns on a side. It's really hard to describe on radio, but let me try to do it. So imagine that your passenger side is the wing and your driver side is another wing. So as you drive, they will be on your right and on your left. As you go up, it turns. And obviously the driver will remain in the same position, right? But around you, everything turns and you have two wings now. It becomes a biplane and you have a very efficient flight.
It sounds, frankly, a little terrifying. Is the idea that you either drive or fly, or is the idea that you're stuck in traffic and then you think, I tell you what, I'm just going to hop up into the air and fly above this?
Yes. Actually, people become really amazed how safe it is once you see it. And yes, you don't have to do the transition. So you have a choice between all three. The basic idea, it should be your ultimate transportation. The ultimate transportation means you choose when you drive, you choose when you fly vertically without transition in the biplane, and you choose when you need to fly for long distances, like, let's say, over 90 miles. You would do the transition and you fly as a biplane. And yes, you can go above, again, don't get me wrong, we got like a very limited FAA certification for very limited flying in limited areas and for limited purposes. But eventually, at some point of time, when we work with FAA, we work with different other authorities in UK, for example, actually UK has a like better jurisdiction for flying cars. We can start getting it more and more and flying more easily.
When you are selling it, it's more than $300,000 a car, is that right?
Yes, the idea from the beginning was to make it affordable, to make sure we replace or work side by side with something like Toyota or Tesla to be your everyday commute vehicle. For that to happen, it needs to be priced around 35K. This is where we're going. As you know, for everybody, including Tesla, and especially something which is a both car and aircraft, the initial price would be high just because of the low volume, just because of the initial production. As we go to the mass manufacturing and as we increase the volume, we hope to get to that magic number of 35K so everybody can afford it.
Jim Duchovny speaking to James Copnell. And that's all from us for now. But before we go, here's my colleague Nick Miles with a request.
Hi, Alex. Well, early next week, we are recording a special global news podcast looking at the opportunities and challenges presented by artificial intelligence. It's been in the news a lot recently with the hype surrounding the new generation of chatbots, but AI goes far beyond that, obviously. It's already being used working to create new medicines, revolutionise films, and find ways of adapting to global warming. So how do you, the listeners, come in? Well, in one sentence, we want you to sum up your hopes or fears about AI. Just send us a short email, or better still, a voice note starting with your name and where you're from, to the normal address, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. So that's just one sentence, and we want you to sum up your hopes or fears about AI. We'll have a panel of experts on hand to answer many of your queries at King's College London. Thanks a lot.
Nick Miles. There will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.